Australia's first computer, made at Sydney University in 1949, weighed a couple of tons and took a big truck to haul down to Melbourne a few years later, where it was named CSIRAC. Now, that stands for Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation Automatic Computer. Peter Thorne was a school kid when he first saw CSIRAC on an expedition to visit Melbourne University. And it's a great pleasure to report that both have survived in fine shape, man and machine. Peter Thorne joins me now to celebrate the remarkable survival in working order of CSIRAC, one of the oldest computers in the world. Peter, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello, nice to be talking to you.
Now, Peter, what do we mean when we talk about a computer in the late 1940s? Are we just talking about an electronic adding machine?
No, there was a big change, in fact, in the late 1940s. Up to that time, there were two real ways of doing calculations. One was to use a desk calculator where you wound a handle, pushed the keys, a bit like a cash register, pushed the keys, or possibly had an electric motor, and that meant that you could do one calculation perhaps every second if you were pretty good with the keyboard. The other was to build a very large mechanical or electromechanical machine, and you plugged cables into it whenever you wanted to change the task it was to do. In the 1940s, after the war, after the Second World War, it was realized that these things need to change. Firstly, you needed an electronic computer, which wasn't limited by mechanical speeds. And secondly, you needed to be able to program it, that was, give it instructions rather than just spend ages replugging it. And so a stored program electronic computer was the holy grail in the 1940s. And the computers we have today, of course, are stored program electronic computers, except today they have transistors, whereas in the 1940s they had to be built with vacuum tubes or valves, those things that used to glow in the back of early radios.
I remember. Warm up the television, warm up the radio. But Peter, this machine that was made, this computer that was made at Sydney University in 1949, was a really early computer.
Yes, indeed it was. The background was that a young scientist by the name of Trevor Pearcey arrived in Australia in 1945, the end of 1945, straight after the war. He was about 26 at the time. At that stage, no stored program electronic computer had worked anywhere in the world. He joined radio physics, which was within the grounds of Sydney University, but actually part of CSIR, later CSIRO. And I'm not quite sure how he managed this, but within a year or so, he'd said, we should build a stored program electronic computer. And they took on the task. He found an engineer, Maston Beard, and they started out to build this computer. Now, they designed it and started construction. It first operated its first stored program at the end of 1949, and by then there were only a couple of others in the world that had beaten it to the punch, one in England and possibly in the US. So this was, and you can argue whether it's the third, fourth, or fifth, depending on how you define it, stored program electronic computer to operate in the world. Done in Australia. In those days, there was no internet, there was no high-speed jet travel, so it was really a remarkable achievement.
How many of those computers, 3, 4, 5, 6, have survived?
None of them have survived. This one has. It's not actually operational, and because it had things like mercury inside it that you wouldn't want to have in a museum, but it is pretty much intact. The others were all dismantled, and in fact, what's happened in the United Kingdom is they've had to build replicas of their early computers to show what they did. We have an intact first generation computer here, the only one in the world.
Didn't they understand what a remarkable historical object they had here. Why dismantle them?
Well, in the early days, they were pulling them apart and building new ones. And because this computer came to Melbourne, as you say, a few years after it first operated, where we put it to work and it worked for another 9 years, by the time it was turned off in 1964, we knew it was historic. We knew it was the only survivor of that first generation. So that's why it survived. The others got washed away in those successive waves we've seen in the whole computing era, where wave after wave of new technology has just swamped the previous waves.
Peter, so let me see if I've got this right. Sydney University, at the cutting edge of computer science, gives its machine to this quiet hollow in Melbourne, where they're happy to go along with the most primitive imaginable computer for year after year, until they realise that it's time to upgrade. Am I being a little unkind there?
Well, what actually happened, I think, was that it was a CSIRO machine, although it was in the grounds of Sydney University. And by about 1955, a remarkable person had appeared at Sydney University itself, in the person of Harry Messel, a notable and very energetic person. And he decided that he would import the design of a computer for the United States. By now, computers were pretty well accelerating in interest and in use. So he started to build Celiac, which was a copy of a Iliac, an American machine. And it became clear that this older first machine was going to become redundant in the future. So it came to Melbourne, and perhaps surprisingly, it did quite a lot of good work there. And although it was terribly slow by modern standards, I mean, a modern computer, you'll see them quoted as 3 gigahertz, which means 3,000 million operations a second. This one did about 1,000 operations a second. And that seems laughable. But just consider, the alternative for a lot of people was a desk calculator doing one operation a second. And we had scientists who were doing calculations that took them 3 months on a desk calculator, just grinding away. And one of them is on record as saying at the end of the time, he realized he made a mistake in the first few days.
Oh, no.
And so somebody showed him this computer. Now, this computer, if you do the sums, could do in 1 hour what took him 3 months on a desk calculator working 8 hours a day. So it was a thousandfold increase in speed. And so people flocked to use it, even though by today's standards it was slow. By those standards, it was a remarkable step forward.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live, I'm talking to Dr. Peter Thorne, who is the former head of the Department of Computer Science at the University of Melbourne, about this remarkable machine, CYRAC, that is still there, not in working order, but fully there at the museum. Peter, I've got here the instructions for using the computer. I don't know whether you've got them handy, but can I read some of them? Procedure for using computer. 1, switch up wall switches 1 and 2. 2, wait 2 minutes. Clunk heard. 3, press white button on machine console. 4, wait 20 minutes. then we go on. And it just obviously took an enormously long time to just warm up.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I was, when still a student, I hung around and made myself sort of useful. And I became the so-called weekend service engineer, which meant that I could do those early steps. If it didn't work, I couldn't fix it, to be honest. But one had to warm up those valves and before one started to use them. So one was turning on something that took 35 kilowatts of power. That's enough to really for a street load of houses. And you had to sort of let it stabilize before you actually put it put it to use. I suppose one can be irritated these days if it takes a few seconds for one's laptop to boot up, but
a millisecond.
20 minutes, yes. So, but once again, this was the wonder of the age. It was also, as you'll notice, a computer that you drove. It was something that you sat and drove at the console.
It looks, in old photographs, a bit like the kind of thing that you'd expect on a disco night, sort of banks of switches. And I must say the men at the console do not look as though they're driving a disco night, but it's got that sort of feel to it. And in 1960, where is it? Yeah, 1960, The Age in Melbourne had this terrific story because the computer had been taught to sing.
Yes, well, in fact, after it was first operated in Sydney, it was programmed to play music, and we are now confident that that was the first digital music, the first computer music ever in history.
In the world.
In the world.
Wow.
And this has been reconstructed, this music, and scientific papers have been published about it. And it really was the beginning, if you like, of multimedia in the sense that the computer could be programmed to play different songs. I must say it sounded a bit like a comb and paper or blowing a gum leaf, but nevertheless, it is recognisable as music. It was actually a brilliant piece of programming, because you had to use the timing of the computer to generate notes which approximated musical tones. But that was one of the notable things about this computer. And, of course, there were quite a few firsts. And later at Melbourne, it was one of the first to do numerical weather forecasting, to actually generate weather models. It did really support science, Australian science, and in some cases Australian business. It did some work for banks and so on. So although these machines were primitive by today's standards, they were really important. And the computational laboratory, as it was called at the University of Melbourne, was fundamental in introducing computers and their potential here. And then later on, other computers came on and did that elsewhere. But that's the thing that we're celebrating later this month, is this establishment of a computer bureau, if you like, in Melbourne, and also setting up teaching of people how to program it and establishing research programs.
But Peter, the whiz who made the computer sing was a Professor Cherry. Did you know him?
Yes, Professor Cherry. Well, he was the person, he took over work that had been done in Sydney. And Professor Cherry was a professor of mathematics at the University of Melbourne and was one of the people who was instrumental in negotiating for it to come to the University of Melbourne when it left CSIRO in Sydney.
Oh, right.
But so he was fascinated with the machine, and he programmed it. He improved the music programming, which had already taken place and been demonstrated to an astounded international audience back in 1951.
But he had his doubts about the machine. The Age reported, a bigger computer, Professor Cherry says, could be programmed in sound pulse patterns to speak with a human voice. But it would be a laborious process, he said, serving little apparent purpose.
Yes, yes. Well, there were quite a few quotes. Trevor Pearcey, who was a remarkable person, had a quote which I think was really quite prescient. This was published in 1948, early, before any store program computer had worked anywhere in the world. And he must have written it in late 1947 because it was published in a journal. And this is the quote. It is not inconceivable that an automatic encyclopedic service operated through the national teleprinter or telephone system will one day exist.
Wikipedia.
Yes, every time one does a search. I mean, that is quite extraordinary. In those days, of course, computers had very little storage capacity. The telephone system was very slow by today's standards, and the teleprinter system. But that was published by Trevor Pearcey in February 48 in a journal. So he must have written that in 47 before any store program computer worked anywhere.
There's wonderful stats that you've given us. Processing speed of CIRAC, 500 to 1,000 hertz. Laptop in 2018, that's years ago. Processing speed, 2.4 billion hertz. Memory capacity, 2,000 bytes for CIRAC. Laptop, 16.5 billion bytes. These are just so remarkable, aren't they?
They are indeed.
Power consumption, 30,000 watts. You were talking earlier about the immense amount of power it required. Laptop, 65 watts. Extraordinary.
Yes,
but
indeed.
Now, Peter, what about this as a task for these commemorations? Why not get CIRAC working again? Would that be possible?
Well,
I mean, what's a bit of mercury between scientists?
Well, that's a question that I've asked, in fact, quite a bit. But the problem is that it's currently the only original machine non-working. If we did we'd have to change a lot, update a lot of the wiring where the insulation would have rotted away over the years, just decayed. We couldn't use the original mercury memory for all kinds of health and safety reasons. So let's assume we did it. In a few years of effort, we would perhaps get it working. And then the people who have the capability of maintaining it, and it took two engineers to do it, would fall off the twig. And then we'd probably end up with a non-working, non-original machine.
Oh, the pessimism of you people is just appalling. But, of course, the valves. I mean, does anybody make those valves anymore?
Yes, you can get valves.
Oh, you can?
Yes. Russia, though, quite a lot of them, and in peaceful times, are sourceable from Russia for some reason.
Well, they've got all those wireless sets out in the tundra where citizens sit around listening to Tchaikovsky.
I assume so. Well, but I must tell you about the valves. One of the more notable things about the valves was that traditionally they had a mean time between failure of about 1,000 hours. So that means if you've got 2,000 of them, you'd assume one of them would give up about every 30 minutes. However, as long as you keep them, look after them, warm them up gradually, as we've seen, and so on, they can last longer. But every now and then, you'll get an intermittent fault in one of the valves, and this will be very irritating. So the person in charge of the computational laboratory, Frank Hurst, made a thing where he had a rubber stopper on the end of a stick. One would run a test program and go along the back of the valves and go bong, 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 like a xylophone. And if you hit the one that was intermittent, the thing would stop. And then you pull that one out and put a new one in. So it was a form of impulse testing, as you might say. And I think in the Museum of Victoria, they might still have the little rubber hammer.
You've got to find it. Please, Peter, you've got to find it. Look, thank you for joining us on the show. But, I mean, I hope you are in full operating condition at the age of 85.
Well, I'm still, as they say, warm and vertical, and I'm looking forward to being at this event and possibly to be around for the 75th as well.
Well, I think the lesson to us all is to warm our valves slowly, don't you?
Yes. Start slowly and warm up, and don't operate too quickly.
Peter, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
You're very welcome.
I've been talking to Dr. Peter Thorne, former head of the Department of Computer Science at the University of Melbourne, who has grown up with CIRAC, this ancient machine, which is still there in Australia, one of the oldest computers in the world. This is Late Night Live.